Please give a rousing Thai welcome to John Doerr and Michael Malone.
Thank you.
Oh, going casual. Okay.
Yeah. How are you?
I'm good. Good to see you, John.
Thank you for such a kind introduction. It's only about half true.
Well, good morning, everybody. What an extraordinary crowd. I think it's been 5 years since way back in the dot-com bubble that I actually came here and got bumped over to the Great America Overflow parking lot. That says something. Means it must be good times around here.
Yeah.
And look at the size of this crowd.
It's amazing. You know, 3,000 entrepreneurs. This has got to be the largest legal creation of future wealth anywhere on the planet.
You know what? You guys ought to give yourselves a hand right now. You guys are the future of mankind.
Thank you.
Well, we have a lot of ground to cover in a very short amount of time, so
yeah, we'll have to fly.
Let's go. Let's start with some history. You know, in researching our conversation today, I was really surprised to learn that Kleiner Perkins has been a sponsor of Thai for 15 years.
Yeah.
I mean, that's before most people in Silicon Valley had even heard of this organization.
Yeah.
Give me some history on that. How'd that happen?
Well, real quickly, we believe in networks, and so I knew Conwell Recky from Novell in the personal computing industry, and Conwell called and said, John, would you back Thai? And we said yes. That's how easy it was.
And the rest is history.
Yeah, well, we've been sponsors ever since.
Now, the other thing I noticed, I was actually researching a column a few months ago, and I went to the Kleiner Perkins website,
right. And
I was sort of surprised by the faces. You know, this isn't your dad's Kleiner Perkins anymore.
No,
it's no longer a sea of white faces.
We have changed a lot in the last 5 years, and I'll tell you, I brought along just a few of my favorite photos. No PowerPoint, but Ellen, would you show us how Kleiner's changed over the last few years? You know, 5 years ago, we were a bunch of angry white men. It was probably 15 engineering geeks. And importantly, I'm going to show you the new face of Kleiner, if I may please. Bill Joyce joined us. But our partnership today of 18 different investors, 35% of them are Indian, Chinese, women. And so great diversity, great international interest, all engineers, all operating experience, and not angry.
How's it changed, besides the anger part, how's it changed the culture of KP and the business
Importantly,
philosophy?
That's a really good question, because we've had the privilege of working with really successful entrepreneurs. And we decided about 5 years ago we ought to try, wherever possible, to back entrepreneurs who were interested in significance as well as success. And that's significance in itself. It says we're not interested in backing the next itinerant regional vice president of sales from Oracle who wants to make an inconsequential enterprise software company. I mean, why bother when you can back, for example, K.R. Sridhar in a stealth company that's going to revolutionize the energy business? And so I think you can do both. You can achieve success and achieve significance.
You know, stand back there behind stage, when they were doing your introduction,
yeah. And
they said you've created 50 jobs a day for the last 20 years. Dude, you've done more than Europe in that time.
Well, I haven't done that. It's the entrepreneurs that we have backed. You've got to remember venture capital is a service industry when it's done right. And I think you want investors who understand the problems that you have, but they also don't, Michael, cross over that chalk line, you know, that means the entrepreneurs are founding and building and running the company, and the investors are there to provide the fuel, the resources. And I don't mean just money. If you're thinking of coming to Kleiner Perkins for just money, it's expensive money, and you shouldn't come. But if you want networking resources, recruiting resources, you want worldwide global introductions or partnerships, if you want some support and backing, then Kleiner Perkins is the place to come.
End of pitch.
Service. More commercials.
Service company. When I think service company, I think of guys with paper hats on in a window.
Well, think about McDonald's.
You guys are a service industry with really nice cars.
Yeah, right.
Just change the subject real quick.
Yeah.
One of the great stories of Silicon Valley over the last 15, 20 years has been the evolution of Indian entrepreneurs in this town, from being engineers primarily to going into management and now breaking into executive row. Right. Got any thoughts on that transformation?
Well, it was obvious, and it's natural, and it's because Indians, I believe, by character are... Well, the culture of this valley has changed. When I first came to Silicon Valley, the predominant culture, this is anecdotal, was Chinese, particularly from Taiwan. And those entrepreneurs are still there. But today, the leaders of entrepreneurial companies, if you pick a single culture, are predominantly Indian. We backed 100 companies over the last 4 years, I think, and fully half of them have leadership from Indians, vice presidents or CEOs. I think 33 of them have one or more Indian vice presidents leading the company, and 15 of them have Indian CEOs.
Okay, then let me ask you a loaded question. That was a pandering answer. Let's ask you a difficult one. Is there a cultural difference in these companies? Philosophical difference?
I believe it's hard to generalize. It really is. Those companies that have Indian leadership have a more global view of their way to assemble resources. Almost without exception, they have a significant R&D operation in India. So
that's an intrinsic advantage.
Intrinsic advantage to those companies. And I find, and of course this varies from person to person, but they're very passionate. Not driven, but passionate. And passion is something different than drive. Passion pulls you forward, whereas drive propels you from behind.
So it's distinctly different from that old Midwestern insanity that started this town.
It could be. I think there's also a sense of wanting to give back to India, give back to the world, that you don't see in other ethnic leadership.
Were you surprised how fast this transformation occurred?
No.
Because, I mean, there was a lot of
were
talk.
Were you surprised?
I thought there'd be more social impediments, you know, in American society.
In society at large, yes. But Silicon Valley, you know, it's a meritocracy. You know, you want the best ideas on the table, the best talent to advance. It's been a great big melting pot. Do they call it that? A boiling pot?
Boiling pot.
Yeah, that's the frog out of the kettle.
Now, let's reverse perspective.
Okay.
KP in India.
Yes.
Now, last time I read, India's producing 300,000
engineers
per year.
Per year.
Probably
that's more than the United States, 56,000 and declining.
This is the largest
new engineer. The U.S. is well-positioned for improvement. Do you want to get a question in here?
Yeah, sure, somewhere in there. Yeah. I'll wait. So this is the largest new engineering pool on Earth and arguably the largest entrepreneurial pool on Earth.
English-speaking in a democracy.
Yeah. So KP in India.
Very important. We have a presence on the ground in India. We're investing in India. We've made two investments already. One is Naukri, which is a fabulous website for listings, kind of a cross between Craigslist and eBay, and so they list jobs. This is very important. You can even post listings for arranged marriages if you want. So it's doing very well. And another one is a stealth new travel service. And with everything in India seems to be low cost. Cell phones, you know, they've opened up the airlines to competition, and so many, many people are flying now. So.
Okay, complete
change. In fact, more people than will fit on the roads.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, quick change again.
Change.
Change
scene.
Let's talk about technology.
Technology.
Now, you know as well, better than anybody, that over the last 50 years, not that you've been here for 50 years, but over the last 50 years.
You have.
Yeah, unfortunately. I still remember little Steve Jobs on the school ground of Mauna Loma Elementary School.
Yeah.
That's how far back I
got. Saw him yesterday.
Did you?
Yeah.
Tell him hi. You've watched the transformation of the technology, the predominant technology in this valley.
Right.
Go from test and measurement instruments to semiconductors.
Microchips.
And microchips to microprocessor to consumer electronics to systems.
And genomics, recombinant
genomics,
DNA. Networking.
And the internet.
Right.
So what's coming next?
I think the next big broad field is going to be biology. Biology is the future. And
not just bioinformatics.
Not just bioinformatics, okay. But biology writ large. And our understanding of materials science and nature and the ability to harness let's just take advantage of a couple billion years of evolution. That's a powerful design advantage. And within that, I believe applying innovation to energy is the so-called next big thing.
Okay, so that's getting us into what you've been talking about lately, which is green tech.
Green
tech,
right.
Is that what you mean by significance as
yes.
opposed to merely
yes.
a financial
right.
investment?
Right.
What do you mean?
By green tech, and I draw a distinction between that and clean tech, I'm really talking about sustainable innovation that will lead to sustainable technologies so that we can have a more secure world for democracies. Our addiction to oil is, I'll talk about that later on. Our friend Tom Friedman is eloquent. But our addiction to oil, we're financing both sides of the war on terrorism, right? We're paying for all these people in Iraq, and then we're paying for the mullahs who are training the anti-democratic terrorists. We have a climate crisis on our hands. Al Gore has a powerful documentary that will air open here in the Bay Area on the 26th of this month called An Inconvenient Truth. And it's really worth seeing. In fact, he loaned me a couple of slides from it, and I wonder, Ellen, if we could look at those. Would you allow me to do that?
Sure, absolutely.
Yeah. This was very, very moving to me and inspirational. I hope it is for everyone. Maybe we should start... Yeah, this should be our favorite major landmass. This is Greenland. And the area in red around it shows you how much the ice shrinks and then comes back every year as we go through the seasons. And the data about Greenland is very important because if Greenland weren't there, if this ice were all to melt, the oceans would rise by 20 feet. Now, this melt area of Greenland has increased by 16% from 1980 to 2000. That's an area roughly the size of Sweden. And even worse than it melting, there was an article in Nature, I believe, just a couple of months ago, that said what's also going on is that the connection of the ice cap to the underlying ground is melting. So there's a potential this could slide right off the surface, and no one knows. Non-linear system. Now, let me go further.
Isn't the center of Greenland actually compressed down
compressed.
Several thousand feet by the weight of the ice?
It is. It is. But let me tell you what a 20-foot rise in the oceans would do. Let's look at the Bay Area if we can, please. That's my favorite photo, number 11. Okay, that's the Bay Area today. Here's the Bay Area with a 20-foot rise in the oceans.
Ooh, there goes my house.
There goes this convention center. Let's go to Mumbai if we can, please. Okay, 40% of the economy, I think, economic activity, is right there. Here's Mumbai under 20 feet of water.
Wow, gone.
There's, for the engineers in the audience, what are we going to do about this? Well, the planet's warming at about 1% a year, 1% a year. We've got to lower that warming rate, and 1% compounded a year is a big number. And this is the formula that describes how this warming happens.
That's the most complicated slide you see today.
No, we need to reduce the carbon output, that's it, the emitted CO2 per year, which is a function of N, the number of people, times GDP, right, that's the economic growth per person, times the primary energy that is required for per unit of GDP, times the carbon that's generated per primary unit of energy. Now, let me tell you this, Michael. I don't think we want to reduce N. That would be the number of people. That's not a solution. In fact, it's going to grow. It's not a good idea to reduce GDP per person either, the second term. So the opportunity for engineers and innovators and policymakers is to work on those last two. Let's get more efficient in getting economic growth out of energy, and then let's get less carbon per unit of energy.
So is that where you're investing? Which of
those
the
last
three
two
variables
terms. No,
there?
Those last two terms.
The last
that's,
two, okay.
Well, we're investing in innovators who are doing that. And
give me
that's
an example.
It. That's the equation. It's that simple.
Give me an example of how you would address
okay, there's that. A terrific Indian entrepreneur, and all the vice presidents in this company are Indian, except one. And he has a stealth company. It will announce its product this year. But it can generate electricity with 40% fewer carbon emissions. It'll be the first practical, working, scalable fuel cell system. Not for cars, but broadly for homes, power plants, institutions. That'd be a big deal.
Give me a sense of how committed KP is to doing this.
Deeply. So we've been working in this field for 5 years. And by the way, it's not the only thing we do. You know, we're working on software and internet and the web and biotechnology and pandemic, actually. But in the last 5 years, we've invested in seven stealth green tech companies. And we decided the time had, most of them are stealth, some are public. But we decided the time had come to be public about this and say it's a priority. And so we earmarked $100 million of our latest fund to investments like that.
And how much have you invested? For all these entrepreneurs out there, how much is left to invest?
100? Well, actually, it turns out we can increase the number, and the limited partners can give us more money pretty much whenever we want. So, we invested $57 million in those seven projects. Are you asking over the life of Kleiner how much have we invested?
Well, I'm just interested how much money is left to invest
dollars.
And that sort of thing.
Oh, we have $1 billion to invest.
Now, is there a different rate of return on these investments?
I think it'll be higher. I think this is the mother of all markets. It's a trillion-dollar component of the worldwide economy.
Are your investors more patient?
Are investors patient? Well, we're patient.
Yeah. I mean, but the payback may be much longer.
No, the payback's really long in biotechnology.
Well, that's true.
Yeah. So it's in the middle, you know. You've got the, you know, blow-away internet website, you know, at Google, and then you've got Genentech. It takes a long time.
Now, let's talk about, you mentioned another word, too, clean tech. What's the difference between clean tech and green tech?
I think, for me, green tech better captures this notion of significance, okay, that... can I borrow a paragraph or two from a friend, Tom Friedman? He wrote the following. He said, look...
He's the New York Times columnist.
New York Times foreign affairs columnist. We should get him to come talk here. In fact, I think he did. He's talked at the Thai conference before. But he wrote a column that really moved me. And I'm going to see if I can find it among all these pieces of paper. And then read it to you. It was great. The title of the column is Green is the Next Big Red, White, and Blue. And particularly because we have the governor coming this afternoon who's been good on this, I think you'll find this interesting. Tom said in January, being green, focusing on greater energy efficiency and conservation is not some girly man kind of issue. It's actually the most tough-minded, geostrategic, pro-growth, and patriotic thing that we can do. Living green is not for sissies. The biggest single threat to democracy in India, in America, is not communism or authoritarianism or even Islamism. He says it's petrolism. Petrolism is the corrupting, anti-democratic practices from Russia to Nigeria to Iran that result from our oil addiction and $60 a barrel oil. Petrolists, so they never have to tap the energy of the people, get great education systems or great economic systems. Instead, they just tap the oil well, and they stay in charge. In petrolist states like Russia, in Sudan, the people get rich by being in government and then sucking the treasury dry. In non-petrolist states like India, Taiwan, and Korea, the people get rich by staying outside government and building real businesses. So no matter what happens in Iraq, we are not going to drain the swamps of terrorism, Islamism in the Middle East, without drying up our oil addiction. We need a president and a Congress with the guts not just to invade Iraq, but also to impose a gasoline and carbon tax and encourage conservation at home. And that takes a real energy policy for innovation. Thank Tom. Thank you. For innovation in renewable energy, you know, whether it's solar cells or biofuels or wind energy, last year's energy bill could be charitably described as welfare for the big oil companies. Or someone else said it's the sum of all lobbyists. There wasn't the mention of a word like fuel efficiency for vehicles in that entire bill. So conservation, energy efficiency, and environmentalism are not some kind of hobby. Real patriots, real entrepreneurs, real advocates of spreading democracy around the world live green. Entrepreneurs who are interested in this field should innovate green. Tom says green is the new red, white, and blue. That'll be his next book. Thanks. Back to you and me.
Let me ask you a very practical question then. Yeah. 5 years down the road now, yeah, investing in green companies, do all the traditional tools of entrepreneurship and venture capital work there? I mean, is there a Moore's Law underlying it? Are there IPOs in the future?
There's not quite Moore's Law. Moore's law is based on a very unusual and aggressive set of improving physics. But remember, there's been no innovation in energy or in the green technologies, clean water, clean transportation, basically no innovation for 30 years. So small changes, remember, a 2% change compounded makes a huge difference. What applies? You got to take risks. You got to focus on markets. You got to assemble a really great team. You need strategic partnerships. And a lot of the marketing is harder. You know, you're dealing in regulated industries where power matters a lot.
Right.
So you got to be a lot more interested in policy and willing to engage in it. You cannot sit back in the garage and invent a new widget and figure the world's going to beat a path to your door.
Well, now you're the VC guru of teams. We have entrepreneurs out here. If they want to start a green company, is it a different kind of team? Is there another kind of figure in that group that you didn't see when they came in with ASICs or dot-coms?
Actually, the stealth company I talked about, it's a semiconductor team of innovators and risk takers, and they're going to bring high-volume semiconductor processing technologies to their fuel cell systems or to a solar cell system. So we're in the right place. If we don't innovate here in these fields, we're screwed. And there's innovation all around the world. I want to say that also. You see folks doing great work in batteries, for example, in Europe. You see innovations in and around bugs that can create energy in India, a rapidly growing pharmaceutical industry. Yeah.
But green seems to be, I mean, it's been called the luxury of developed countries, of wealthy countries. That's still the case?
It's the imperative of the developing countries. China has higher automotive fuel standards for new cars than does the United States of America. And the U.S. consumes 24% of the world's energy with 4% of the world's people. Now, I want to tell you, these people, these growing, aggressive, economic, free market Chinese and Indians, they have the same aspirations our families do. They want clean water, clean power, clean transportation, and a better life for their kids, a good education. If India and China develop the way the United States has, we're going to choke this planet to death. We'll poison it and pollute it. We've got to innovate.
Another practical question for these folks out here.
Yeah.
Is the investment process the same thing? Is it still seed round, first and second round of VCs?
Yeah.
Is there a liquidity moment? Do you go public as a green company?
Sure. Four of the best performing IPOs in the last year were solar energy companies. One in China, a couple here. T.J. Rogers, I hear, was here earlier. I love T.J.
Well, let me play T.J. for a moment.
All right.
I'll be the tough guy. I'll play devil's advocate here.
Be literal.
You know, John, I think you're working with your heart instead of your head on this one.
No, I don't think so. I think this could well be the largest economic opportunity of the 21st century.
Okay, from the positive to the terrifying. Yeah. You mentioned a word a few moments ago that I bet everybody out there heard it, and it sort of rattled in their brain for a moment, and then we went on. Pandemic.
Pandemic.
What are you doing in that area?
You may have seen, Michael, that we raised a special fund, a $200 million fund, called the Kleiner Perkins Pandemic Preparedness Fund. And how many, show of hands, please, how many people know about the Spanish flu of 1918? Okay. About a fourth of us, maybe even a fifth, 20%. Ellen, we have a slide for that, don't we, that shows what the pandemic was like? So in 2 years, this swept around the world, this pandemic, and a third of the world got sick, and the world was small and not very connected. 160 million people, it's estimated, died, 400,000 in the U.S. And we discovered in science just last fall that the virus that caused that was an avian virus.
Right.
We have pandemics every about two or three times a century. And all that has to happen is for this H5N1, for example, we already have a bird pandemic, to mutate slightly so that it's human transmissible.
It's like a combination of three mutations or something, isn't it?
That's right. Change three genes. We're done. And the estimates are that as many as 100 million people in the U.S. could die if there's a really severe pandemic. And it will devastate Africa and be terrible for Southeast Asia. So what do? Do you just, run away with your family and be isolated? No. you go out and you find the world's best entrepreneurs, and you work on surveillance and detection, then very inexpensive diagnostics. We're backing a team that has a pregnancy test, except you put it in your nose. It turns pink or blue, depending on whether or not you've got H5N1 or not. That's important to isolate and treat the people that really have the disease right there on the spot.
So you're not depending upon the World Health Organization
or the
National Institute of Health.
We need it. We need all those organizations, but they're not moving fast enough.
But this is like Glenn Reynolds' Army of Davids, right?
Absolutely. That's okay. Right. We need innovation. Better antiviral than Tamiflu, something called Paramivir, 10 times as potent. Thermally stable, which means you can take it into Southeast Asia and into Africa. And our theory with all of these is we are going to back the entrepreneurs who want to license it or make it available at cost or even for free to the developing world, and then we'll sell it on commercial terms in the developed world. Nothing else makes sense. So when I went to India a month and a half ago, I got to meet with the health minister and the CEOs of 4 Indian pharmaceutical companies, and they want to license this. We'll license them all, you know, and the best way to get it to Africa and get it to Southeast Asia.
This has to be a very strange business model, though, in that when people come in with a web company, you know there's going to be a finished product at such and such a date, and there'll be users.
Right.
But you have something where it may never have a use, and then we hope it doesn't.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I mean, there's a famous story about when the flu hit San Francisco. There were 4 society ladies playing bridge one night.
Yeah.
They played to 11 o'clock at night, and by the next morning at 8 a.m., 3 of them were dead and 1 was dying. It hit that fast. So
it will hit very fast if it happens. The experts tell me, go ahead, there's
you're talking to businesses that are either never going to be used or they're going to be used in a state of absolute international chaos.
Well, by the time we have chaos, it's too late. So I believe that most of us, if we had the opportunity to get an inexpensive diagnostic and then something better than Tamiflu, we'd buy that for our families and put it in the medicine cabinet. Turns out they didn't make enough Tamiflu and the U.S. government didn't order enough in advance. But they're moving, finally. And what I believe we can't do is we cannot wait for the, and we've seen this, for the grant process for the NIH and the CDC to fund and accelerate the innovation. And it's a truly global problem. So we got a special team of partners who are working on this. We've got a couple $100 million. And we've already invested in 4 companies? I guess 3, right. A better vaccine company also.
Okay, now this isn't a monolithic type of industry.
This is a network.
But aren't there specific industries?
Just like Thai.
Yeah, aren't there specific industries within this?
Oh,
what
yeah.
are they? Where are the business opportunities for these folks?
There's an opportunity, I think, around better surveillance and detection. It turns out the way people find infectious diseases in the world right now is by crawling the web. There's a group in GFIN in Canada that crawls 7,000 local newspapers in 7 languages. Well, we got to do 70,000 newspapers in 70 languages. Certainly opportunities for better diagnostics, better communications, SMS communication back and forth. And then a lot of this is bio, I have to tell you. It's life sciences. It's antivirals, vaccines. And finally, if we could have something that quieted the cytokine storm. When I was in Beijing, trip before last, I got to see the histopathology, I guess it is, of 3 people who died out of 8, they say in China, 3, of avian flu. There was a 34-year-old woman, a 24-year-old woman who was pregnant, and her fetus. And if you looked at the slide of these lungs, the lungs were essentially gone. The reaction to the virus was so violent that there was what they call a cytokine storm, and it's very chilling. I think, so I'm not considered an alarmist. I think we want to hope for the best, prepare for the worst, and if this mutates, hope that it's not very transmissible and it's not very lethal. That could happen.
Now, apparently the good news is, as of yesterday, I think, it looks like the migratory birds going into Europe aren't carrying it.
Yeah, well, not this season.
But do you feel the clock running on this?
Do
you feel...
No, we're in a hurry.
Do you worry about this a lot?
Yeah. I think the pandemic is a crisis that's really urgent, and I think climate change is a crisis that we got to get on right away. That's a longer-term project.
Let's change topic again.
Okay.
There's a new phenomenon out there in the world that I know you're very interested in. And actually, you and I have both been involved with it, and that's social entrepreneurship.
Right.
Give me a quick definition in your mind what that is and how it relates to traditional commercial entrepreneurship.
Right. So entrepreneurs, we're in awe of entrepreneurs. They do more than anyone thinks possible with less than anyone thinks possible. And social entrepreneurs are working on a double bottom line. You know, they're trying to build a sustainable operation. Mohamed Yunus is one of my favorite. I'm working with him. I joined the board of the Grameen Bank. He says, look, I want to run non-loss businesses and drive poverty out of this world so that yours and my children will only be able to see poverty in a poverty museum. We can do this, and I think we'll get there through microcredit. Or I consider Bono and his data organization to be a social entrepreneur. Also, he's a famous rock singer, but he says, where you live should not decide whether you live or whether you die. And then there's that famous Indian, Venkat, who has done such amazing things to provide for cataract surgery and eliminate blindness. So social entrepreneurs.
The Oral Lab Project.
Thank you very much. We should back these entrepreneurs. Wherever you see it, find your passion and back them. It's another way to make meaning as well as making money.
What does venture capital have to do with this, though?
Well, venture capitalists are pretty good at finding risk takers and backing them and helping them accelerate their growth into big sustainable change. Look,
different ROIs. They have a whole different... They don't even have metrics, many of them.
Oh, no, they do. You think the Grameen Bank doesn't have metrics?
Grameen Bank does, but...
You think Data, the organization that's trying to drive AIDS out of Africa and increase trade and get debt forgiven, they have metrics.
Yeah, but does Moses Zulu at Children's Town in Zambia, AIDS orphanage, he doesn't report, he doesn't come back and say, this is my earnings for the year.
No. But do you think... Actually, you know, I should not be talking about this. Michael Malone has done a whole television series called what? The New Heroes. On the social entrepreneurs. But do you think they have metrics?
I think they're emerging.
Right.
And I think when they fully emerge, they will attract investment.
Right.
But between now and then, what does a John Doerr do besides... I mean, personally, I can understand where you are, but does KP get involved in this?
We do this as individuals. Okay. And some of my partners... And by the way, we can change policy as well. We care about... not just global poverty, but education. Partners and friends of mine passed a proposition in California, Prop 39, that's gotten 18, thanks to the voters of California, $18 billion in funding for California schools and created over 500 charter public schools, or at least the facilities for them, in this very state, schools of choice. Another proposition just last cycle was Prop 71. How many people here were in favor of embryonic stem cell research in California? Hands in the air, please. Okay? Well, we raised $30 million, and as a result, there's $3 billion that will be available over the next decade to do that important work. If you cannot succeed in Washington, you go to Sacramento. If you cannot succeed in Sacramento, you go to the people of California with an initiative. Thank you.
That brings us to the third rail, which is historically social entrepreneurs oftentimes have a very strong political dimension to what they're doing because they're oftentimes taking on things like government corruption.
Yeah, right.
Silicon Valley historically has done its best to stay out of politics, well, except for you.
No, not.
Does politics have a more important role, you think? In the future
of
Silicon Valley, of entrepreneurship?
In the future of the world, of policy. You know this whole concern I have about climate change? I want to tell you the one change we could make that would solve that whole problem. And that would be to get a global closed system that's market-based for caps and trades is what it's called. But basically a market system for greenhouse gases, for CO2. We almost got there with a somewhat flawed system called the Kyoto Protocol, which U.S. government and this administration refused to sign. There's another round of Kyoto talks going on. If we get that market system in place, then there's going to be all the incentives we need to innovate, to get cars with the right efficiency standards, to get solar, renewable energy in place. So let me have that one policy change. Let us have a president who will make that a priority, and we'll do the most important thing. God, this is sounding like a political campaign, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah.
Let's get back to technology.
Let me ask you, I want to ask you the one last question about social entrepreneurs, a very practical question once again, and that is, social entrepreneurs come in a lot of different forms.
Yeah.
I mean, you have Muhammad Yunus, Grameen Bank in Bangladesh.
Right.
You have Apertech with the water pumps in Kenya.
Yeah. That's a terrific project.
And Oral Labs with the cataract surgery in India. Yeah. You have Kailash Satyarthi rescuing dead bondage slaves in India. You have a whole bunch of different types of social entrepreneurs.
Right.
Are there any particular areas that you think venture capital can be involved in a very, you know, engaged way?
It's a really good question. Can I ask you? You know so much about this field.
Well, I mean, social entrepreneurship runs the entire spectrum from for-profit to absolutely not-for-profit to all sorts of stuff in between.
Right.
And obviously you guys can get involved in the for-profit. It's that in-between stuff that is an interesting challenge for you guys that I'm not sure anybody's solved yet.
Right. So I believe not just venture capitalists, but all the great entrepreneurs. We've got 3,000 entrepreneurs here today, which is why we're spending so much time on this, can help the social entrepreneurs build businesses that are scalable and sustainable. They don't have to be profitable. They can be break-even. But look, you can do very good personal work in the small. An individual can change a single school, can work in a village and bring clean water to it. But I think the people here, the venture capitalists I know, they dream about doing something big, something scalable.
Yeah, think of all the intellectual capital sitting out there right now.
You know, it all depends. Do you want to build an inconsequential enterprise software company, or do you want to innovate on the web or green or in chip technology and help others or yourself change the world? That's the choice.
One last question before we take questions.
This is fun.
In your 3 a.m.s, the 3 a.m.s of your soul, I think.
Yeah, I worry about my teenage daughter.
Yeah. As F. Scott Fitzgerald said, when you look out there in the future, what's the biggest opportunity you can imagine? The most impact, the biggest payoff, the biggest everything.
Tech entrepreneur. I mean, it's not policy, because my answer to the policy.
Yeah, not policy. As a venture capitalist, if you're going to swing for the fences, if these guys are going to swing for the fences, what is it?
I guess I'd like to find a way to revolutionize the energy industry so that everywhere around the world, in every nation, people could grow their own energy from bugs or from switchgrass or, as Brazil has done, from sugarcane. And let's get the enabling technologies, the catalysts, so that that's very efficient at large scale or for individuals or in neighborhoods. That would be a big opportunity.
Let me take some questions.
Yeah.
Two of them actually have to do with energy. I think you've touched a nerve here today. What have you done to back companies in the alternative energy sector? And can you tell us more about the stealth company that will revolutionize the energy industry? And are options available, apparently?
So no, I can't talk about the stealth companies. And I actually think smart entrepreneurs stay stealth until they have a product that's ready to be sold. You know why? And what have we done? We've invested in large and small fuel cell companies. We've invested in solar companies. We've invested in companies that hope to turn bugs into energy. We've invested in companies that hope to scale up biofuels. We're investing. And I probably skipped. I'm sure I've missed one or two. So I'd love to find a company that can make a big scalable difference about clean water. Today, water is going to be in such short supply, particularly if there's climate crisis. But 10,000 people die today, the single largest cause of death, because they choke to death on their own vomit. They typically have dysentery, and that's because they don't have clean water. Clean water.
Any words of wisdom to pitch for VC funding on my idea?
Yeah.
If you were not to fail, what three things would you do and why?
Okay, so the first thing I'd do as an entrepreneur, if you're seeking that funding, is I'd talk to some other successful entrepreneur. And do we have to stop now? If you called some entrepreneur and said, I want to have lunch, I want to learn about what you're doing, that entrepreneur will also be able to introduce you to a great resource we have in Silicon Valley, which is the venture capital community. The second thing I do is write a very simple plan. And third, get going now. There's never been a better time than now to start a new technology company, a new energy, green tech company, a new biotech company. So I say go for it. Is this the last question?
Last question.
And then I have a closing thought.
Given that you're on the board of Google, should an entrepreneur that is building a new search company with a disruptive new algorithm come and talk to you? Should they come talk to you about destroying the company you have a major investment in?
But here's what would happen. First of all, we have a Chinese wall, and we would never take any entrepreneur's plans to any other company. If we did that, it's a small valley, we'd be out of business. I personally wouldn't be able to be involved in the project, but one of my better partners, Randy Komisar or Ray Lane or Bill Joy, could get involved in that project and help go build it. And there's a lot of companies that are building businesses that Google might someday do. And if Google's going to do it, Microsoft will probably do it, and so will likely Yahoo. And those businesses get escape velocity. They may or may not be acquired. Once a business is public, it's for sale, right? Almost always. Final thought?
You have a challenge for the audience.
Yeah, here's my challenge. Ellen, would you help me with this slide? If you would like a copy of the photos and also the transcript, I think Michael Malone's done a terrific job here of what we've talked about today. If you would send me the names of your three favorite books, do not send the books, please, just the names of them, then I'll send you back the names of the three books that have changed my life. And we can begin a kind of email conversation. So if you'll join me in thanking Michael Malone, the raconteur of Silicon Valley, we'll close this off.
Well,
thank you.
The nice thing about being the host is I get to officially close it. And I think you all will agree with me that John Doerr is not only an extraordinary venture capitalist, but he's also an extraordinary human being. So let's give him a big hand.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Good fun. We're out of here.
All right.